but the Codex store offered an employee discount on film. Not that he'd needed any lately. He hadn't taken a new photograph in 6 months. He spent his free time helping Mr. Song mop up water from the basement or plant mouse traps or whatever little chores he could do around the building to earn reduced rent. He unclogged the park's toilet, fixed the Shaw's broken pantry shelf, fished into the kitchen sink for Mrs. Choi's fallen wedding ring. If he came across a job he didn't know how to do, he called Barry for help. "I told you that place was a dump," Barry said. But what were they supposed to do? Their old landlord had jacked up the rent, so off to Koreatown it was. In a way, it was an adventure. The new foods to try, the signs you couldn't read, the language spoken around you, on the bus or the street, that allowed you to drift off into your own thoughts. The neighbors in the gardens, mostly elderly like the Choys and the Parks and the Songs, who pitied those two young people living in the apartment with the leaky ceiling and brought them sticky rice cakes for Christmas. But the ceiling, the cramped bedroom, the tiny kitchen, Rhys said that if he helped enough around the gardens, maybe they'd save so much on rent they could find a new place. But by then, Jude hoped that she would be gone. "You worrying about nothing," her mother told her once over the phone. "You a smart girl." "Plenty of people are smart, Mama." "Not like you," her mother said. Whenever they hung up, Jude always felt a little guilty, knowing that the life she most feared was the one her mother was already living, waiting tables forever, living in a cramped home. At least she had Rhys. At least she wasn't in Mallard. She could be grateful for that, even if she couldn't stop herself from projecting into the future. Each time she mentioned spring, Rhys shifted a little, a distant look falling over his face, like he didn't want to talk about it. That night, after she closed Parks, they walked home, Rhys's arm around her shoulders. On the corner outside the gardens, a pale, dark-haired woman passed, and Jude held her breath. But it was just a white woman gliding underneath the streetlights. It couldn't be Stella. For years after that Beverly Hills party, Jude had thought of little else. Sometimes the woman in the fur coat looked exactly like her mother, down to the curve in her smile. Other times, she was only slender and dark-haired, a passing resemblance at best. After all, she'd only caught a glimpse of the woman before the wine splashed against her leg. Then she was scrambling to pick up the shattered glass while the whole party gawked. This, of course, stayed with her too. How she'd groped along the table for cocktail napkins before Carla pushed her out of the way, frantically blotting the ruined rug. By the time she'd dumped the wine-bloodied napkins into the trash, Carla told her to leave and never come back. She'd quietly gathered her purse, too embarrassed to glance around the room, lest she lock eyes with one of the many witnesses to her humiliation. She looked up once as she shut the door behind her, and she didn't see the woman at all, only the girl with the violet eyes watching her leave, pink lips curled into a smirk. A dark-haired woman who could have been anyone. Maybe she just missed her mother so much, she'd convinced herself of the resemblance. Maybe she felt guilty about not going home, about never going home. And this woman was a projection of her subconscious. Or maybe, no, she wouldn't even consider that possibility. That she had been in the same room with Stella, that she'd caught eyes with her even, before she'd dropped that wine bottle and shattered everything. "What's wrong, baby?" Rhys had asked later that night. "You're shaking." They were walking to meet Barry at Mirage. She hadn't said much since she'd returned home early, but Rhys looked worried, pausing under the stoplight, and she knew that she had to tell him the truth. "I lost my job," she said.
"What? What happened?"
"It's stupid. I saw Stella. I mean, I thought it was her. I swear, she looked just like her." She felt even crazier saying it aloud. that she'd gotten herself fired because she'd caught a glimpse, through a crowded party, of a woman who may have resembled her mother. "I can't believe I was so stupid," she said. He pulled her into a hug.
"Oh, it's all right," he said. "You'll find another job."
"But I wanted to help you. I thought if we both put money away." He groaned.
"That's why you were working so crazy?"
"I just thought if the both of us..."
"But I didn't ask you to do that," he said.
"I know," she said. "I just wanted to. Don't be mad, baby. I just wanted to help." She wrapped her arms around him, and after a moment, he held her back.
"I'm not mad," he said. "I just don't like feeling like some charity case."
"You know I don't think of you like that."
"You gotta tell me things," he said. "You're so hidden away sometimes."
Maybe that was what drew them together. Maybe this was the only way they knew how to love, drawing near, then ducking away. He touched her cheek and she tried to smile. "Okay," she said. "No more hiding." For years, Stella drifted through her dreams. Stella draped in mink, Stella perched on a ledge, Stella shrugging, smiling, slipping in and out of doors. Always Stella, never her mother, as if even asleep she could tell the difference. She always awoke, shaken. She was tired all the time. She found a new job dishwashing in a campus cafeteria for $2 an hour, where she spent her shift alone, steaming piles of cruddy plates clean. Each evening, she came home with pruned fingers, her shoulders stooped. At one point, she was 3 weeks behind on a history paper, and her GPA was teetering so dangerously, her track coach called her into his office.
"You're smarter than this," he said.
And she nodded, chastened, springing from the claustrophobic office as soon as he dismissed her. Yes, yes, she would work harder, apply herself more. Of course, she took school seriously. Of course, she wanted to compete in the spring. Of course, she couldn't lose her scholarship. She was just a little distracted at the moment, nothing too serious. She would shake out of it. But she didn't, because every time she tried to study, she only imagined Stella. "Do you still think about her?" she asked her mother one afternoon.
"Who?"
Jude paused, wrapping her finger around the telephone cord. "Your sister," she finally said. She couldn't bring herself to say Stella's name, like it would conjure her again. Stella strolling by on the sidewalk outside, Stella appearing in the fogged window.
"Now why are you asking about all that?"
her mother said.
"I don't know. I'm just wondering. Can't I wonder?"
"No use in wondering," her mother said.
"I stopped wondering long ago. I don't think she's even here anymore."
"Living?" Jude said. "But what if she is? I mean, what if she's just out there somewhere?"
"I would feel her,"
her mother said quietly. And Jude began to think of Stella as a current running under her mother's skin, under her own skin, dormant until that party when she'd locked eyes with Stella across the room. Then a leap, a spark, her arm jolting from her side. Now she was trying to forget that charge. She thought, once or twice, about telling her mother about the woman at the party. But what good would that do? It was Stella, it wasn't. She was dead, she was alive. She was in Omaha, Lawrence, Honolulu. When Jude stepped outside, she imagined bumping into her. Stella pausing on the sidewalk, admiring a purse through a shop window. Stella on the bus, hanging on to the vinyl strap. No, Stella in a smooth black limousine, hiding behind the tinted glass. Stella everywhere, always, and nowhere at the same time. In November 1982, A musical comedy called The Midnight Marauders opened in a nearly abandoned theater in downtown Los Angeles. The playwright, a 30-year-old still living at home in Encino, was determined to make it in a city where, he claimed to friends, no one valued theater. He'd written The Midnight Marauders as a joke, and of course, the joke always being on him, it was his only success. The play ran at the Stardust Theater for 4 weekends, was nominated for a local award, and earned tepid praise in the Herald Examiner. But Jude would have never heard about it if Barry hadn't landed a spot in the chorus line. For weeks leading up to the audition, he was a nervous wreck, bouncing on his heels as he practiced Somewhere Over the Rainbow. He had never sung in front of anyone before, dressed only as himself. "I felt naked out there," he told her after the audition. "I was sweating like a hog on Easter Sunday." She was happy for him when he earned his spot in the company. He sent her tickets for opening night, but she told Reese that she had to work. "Ask for the night off," he said. "We gotta support him. And we never go out anymore. We should have a little fun." The previous month, his car engine had died, and he'd emptied his savings to fix it. All those crumpled bills in his sock drawer, gone. He'd started working the door at Mirage to make extra cash on the weekends. The muscle, technically, although he was mostly just a handsome face greeting the customers. So far, he'd only broken up one drunk fight and earned a cut on that handsome face as gratitude. In the bathroom, he'd winced as Jude dabbed the cut with alcohol, missing those weekends they used to spend chasing sunlight across the marina in search of the perfect shot. Reese biting his lip as the shutter clicked. Now, on Friday and Saturday nights, he left in a black t-shirt and black jeans and came home at dawn, his hands flecked with glitter from helping the go-go dancers onto the stage. Then off to the Kodak store, or helping Mr. Song. Some days, she barely saw him at all, only feeling him drop into bed beside her. She couldn't afford to miss a night of work in order to sit in a damp theater, enduring 3 hours of amateur acting in hopes of catching a glimpse of Barry in the chorus line. Still, she agreed, running her fingers through Reese's hair. They needed a night out. One night where she didn't think about spring decisions, where he didn't obsess over money, where they wouldn't worry about anything at all. On opening night, she slipped into a purple dress and glided pantyhose up her legs as Reese, tying his tie, smiled at her through the mirror. They were overdressed because they never had anywhere nice to go. Tonight was an excuse to pretend otherwise. They could pretend to be anything. A young couple on a first date, newlyweds sneaking away from the children, a pair of sophisticated theatergoers who never worried about money, never clipped coupons, never counted change. "Fancy, fancy," Louise teased, when they all met up in the lobby with a dozen of the other boys she used to see scrambling around backstage in bustiers. Soon they were all laughing, clamoring into the mildewed theater, everyone giddy as the lights dipped.
"This better be good,"
Reese stage whispered, but he was so good-natured about it, she could tell he didn't care. He kissed her as the orchestra began to play a jaunty overture. The curtains parted, and she leaned forward, straining to see Barry. He was high-kicking with the other dancers, wearing a fringed leather vest and cowboy hat. She giggled, watching him twirl a redhead. Then the dancers receded, and the show lead appeared center stage, a blonde girl in a long, hooped dress. Her singing voice was pretty, if plain. Still, she was charming enough, delivering her lines with a wryness so familiar that in the darkness, Jude reached for her playbill. And there she was, the blonde girl with the violet eyes. After the curtain fell, after a beaming Barry took his bow, after the audience slowly trampled across the fading red carpet into the lobby, dissecting plot holes and glaring miscues, Jude circled with her friends outside the stage door. The group was chatty, debating drink plans while they waited for Barry to emerge so that they could embarrass him with thunderous applause. But she hugged herself, shifting from foot to foot, staring down the alley, expecting at any moment her mother's ghost to appear. She'd slipped out of the theater during intermission, certain that in the darkness she had mistaken the girl in the playbill for the girl at the Beverly Hills party. But there she was, in full light. Born in Brentwood, Kennedy Sanders studied at USC, but left early to pursue a career in acting. She recently played Cordelia, King Lear, Jenny, Death of a Salesman, and Laura, The Glass Menagerie. This is her first appearance at the Stardust Theater, though hopefully not her last. In her headshot, the girl smiled, her wavy blonde hair falling angelically to her shoulders. She looked innocent here, nothing like the sassy girl who demanded a martini from her at a party, and she might have believed that this was a different white girl altogether if not for those eyes. She could never forget them. If that girl was in the show, did that mean that the woman in the fur coat was here too? What if it was Stella? What if it wasn't? She'd wandered around the lobby until the house lights flickered, but she never saw a woman who looked like her mother. Now she felt even crazier than before. "You all right, baby?" Reese asked. She nodded, trying to smile. "I'm just cold," she said. He wrapped his arms around her, warming her up. Then the stage door opened, but instead of Barry wandering out, Kennedy Sanders stepped into the alley, fumbling with a pack of Marlboros. She looked startled to see the crowd waiting, and for a second she smiled expectantly before realizing that no one was there to see her. Then her eyes flickered to Jude. She smirked. "Oh," she said, "it's you." She remembered her, 3 years later. Of course she did. Who would forget a dark girl who'd spilled wine all over an expensive rug? "My friends and this show," Jude said. Kennedy shrugged, shaking a cigarette into her palm. She was wearing a tattered Sex Pistols t-shirt that stopped above her navel, jean shorts over ripped fishnet tights, and black leather boots. She looked nothing like the Beverly Hills princess from that party. She started walking down the alley, and Jude scrambled after her. "Barry," she said. "He's in the chorus." "Is that your boyfriend?" Kennedy asked. "Barry?" "No, silly. Him." She jerked her head back toward the group. "The one with the curly hair." "He's a doll. Where'd you find him?" "At school," she said. "Well, really, at this party." "You have a light?" Kennedy slid a cigarette into her mouth. When Jude shook her head, she said, "Just as well. Bad for the singing voice, you know?" "I thought you were amazing tonight," Jude said. She didn't really, but she would have to flatter this girl to get anything out of her. "Your folks must be proud." Kennedy scoffed. "Please, they hate that I'm doing this." "Why?" "Because they sent me to school to do something practical, you know? Not drop out and throw my life away. At least that's what my mother says. Hey, do you have a light?" She flagged down a shaggy-haired white man smoking on the corner. "Well, so long." She hurried over to the man on the corner, who smiled as he leaned in to light her cigarette. A flicker in the darkness. Then she was gone. Barry said that Kennedy Sanders was a rich bitch.
"You know the type," he told Jude. "A couple of solos in the high school choir, and now she thinks she's Barbra Streisand."
He was putting on his face in the backstage of Mirage for the Sunday brunch show, the only time slot available now that the Midnight Marauders had taken over his evenings. He hated the early call time and the thinner crowds, but he loved being Bianca too much to wait 3 weeks until the play closed. He gestured behind him, and Jude yanked the hairbrush jutting out of his gym bag. So what do her parents do? She asked.
Who knows?
They haven't been by the theater?
Hell no, Barry said. You think they'd come around that dump? No, ma'am. She comes from real money. Some hoity-toity folks. Big house in the hills, all that.
Why are you asking about her anyway?
No reason, she said. But that afternoon, she rode the bus downtown to the Stardust Theater. The Sunday matinee was starting in a half hour. The teenage usher wouldn't let her inside without a ticket, so she paced on the sidewalk under the green eaves. She already felt foolish riding down in the first place. What would she even say to Kennedy? She tried to think of what Early might do. The key to hunting, he told her, is pretending to be someone else. But she'd never been able to be anyone but herself. So when the usher shooed her away, she slunk off to the sidewalk. Of course, right then she bumped into Kennedy, hustling toward the entrance. She wore jean shorts so short the pocket flaps were showing, and a pair of worn cowboy boots.
Sorry, they both said. Then Kennedy laughed.
Well, goddamn, she said. You following me or something?
No, no, Jude said quickly. I'm looking for my friend, but they won't let me inside. I don't have a ticket.
Kennedy rolled her eyes.
Like Fort Knox in here, she said.
Then she told the usher, she's with me. And like that, Jude was fumbling after her through the lobby, past backstage, and into her dressing room. The room was barely bigger than a closet, the yellow paint chipping off the walls. Under the dim mirror lights, Kennedy plopped into the worn leather chair.
Donna wanted to skin you alive, she said.
What? Jude said.
After you ruined her rug? God, you should have seen her, running around like you'd slaughtered her firstborn. My rug! My rug! It was a riot. Well, not for you, probably.
She spun in her chair, eyeing herself in the mirror.
What's your name, anyway?
Jude.
Like the song?
Like the Bible.
I like it,
Kennedy said.
Hey, Jude, not to be a bitch or anything, but I've got to change.
Oh, Jude said, I'm sorry. She started to back out the door, but Kennedy said,
don't go. You can help me.
I can never get into this thing on my own. She was tugging the big hooped dress from the opening number out of the closet. Jude smoothed the wrinkles out of the orange fabric as Kennedy yanked her t-shirt over her head. She was slender and tan, wearing a matching pink bra and panty set. Jude tried not to watch, staring instead at the cluttered countertop covered in pallets of makeup, a curling iron, gold earrings, a crumpled candy wrapper.
So where you from, hey Jude? Kennedy said. Bring that over, will you? Jesus, I hate this thing. It always makes me sneeze.
She lifted her arms, and Jude stared into the smoothness of her armpits as she helped lift the dress over her head. True to her word, Kennedy let out one dainty sneeze before slipping her arms into the sleeves.
Louisiana, Jude said. No kidding. So's my mother. I'm from here. Well, I don't know if you can say you're from a place if you've never left. Can you? I don't know how anything works. Zip me?
She spoke so quickly, Jude felt dizzy following along.
Which part? She asked. Hey, can you hurry? Curtain's in 20, and I haven't done my makeup yet.
She pulled her blonde hair off her shoulder. Jude stepped behind her, tucking the zipper.
What's your mother's last name? She said. Maybe I know her people.
Kennedy laughed.
I doubt that.
What was she doing? She'd seen a woman who may have looked like her mother, and now she'd ended up stalking a white girl and helping her into a ridiculous costume? What did she care anyway? She'd never even met Stella. Kennedy leaned into the mirror, powdering her face. For the first time, she was quiet and focused, like Barry right before a performance.
I have to get into my zone, he always said, shooing Jude before his curtain call.
Sometimes she lingered in the doorway and watched as a veil seemed to drop before his face. One moment he was Barry, The next, Bianca. She could see a similar moment passing through Kennedy right now. It felt more intimate to witness than seeing the girl in her underwear. She turned to leave.
You don't know anyone named Veens, do you?
Kennedy called after her.
That's my mother's name, or was her name.
She glanced over her shoulder.
Estelle Veens, but everyone calls her Stella.
Chapter 11. Statistically speaking, the likelihood of encountering a niece you'd never met at a Beverly Hills retirement party was improbable, but not impossible. Which Stella Sanders might have, at least intellectually, understood. Improbable events happened all the time, she tried to explain to her students, because improbability is an illusion based on our preconceptions. Often it has nothing to do with statistical truth. After all, it's wildly improbable that any one person is alive. A particular sperm cell fertilizing a particular egg, producing a viable fetus. Twins are more likely to be stillborn, identical twins more vulnerable than fraternal twins. Yet here she was, teaching introduction to statistics at Santa Monica College. Likely does not mean certain. Improbable does not mean impossible. She discovered statistics unexpectedly in her second year at Loyola Marymount University. She didn't call herself a sophomore then. She was 10 years older than everyone else in the class, so the title felt silly. She didn't even know what she wanted to study, only that she liked numbers. Statistics entranced her because so many people misunderstood it. In Las Vegas, she'd sat beside Blake in a smoke-filled casino as he lost $400 at the craps table, staying in the game longer than he should have because he was convinced that he was due. But dice owed you nothing.
It doesn't matter what's already rolled,
she finally told him, exasperated.
Each number is equally likely if the dice are fair, which they're not.
She takes one class,
Blake told the man sitting next to them. The man laughed, puffing at his cigar.
I always stay on, he said. Rather lose than know I would have won if I hadn't played it safe.
Well said. Blake and the man clinked their glasses. Statistical truth, like any other truth, was difficult to swallow. For most people, the heart decided. Not the mind. Stella was like everyone else in this regard. Hadn't her decision to follow Blake from New Orleans been an emotional one? Or her choice to stay with him over the years? Or her agreement to, say, attend Bert Hardison's retirement party, even cajoling her daughter to appear because Blake claimed they needed to show a united front? One big happy family. It mattered to the rest of the partners. Blake was a marketing man who understood the value of his own brand, Stella and Kennedy merely an extension of it. So she'd agreed to go to that party. In spite of everything, she'd whisked around the living room, playing the dutiful wife, even as Bert Hardison, smelling like brandy, crowded near her all night, his hand on her waist, as if she wouldn't notice. But Blake, of course, didn't see, huddling in the corner with Rob Garrett and Yancey Smith, while Stella tried to make small talk with Donna Hardison, keeping an eye on her daughter, who kept inching near the bar and avoiding the red stain on the white rug that a lanky black man was feebly blotting with soda water. There'd been a disturbance earlier, a black girl spilling wine on the rug, which had, for a few moments, stolen the attention of everyone at the party. Stella had just arrived, so she'd only seen the aftermath. A charcoal girl, frantically mopping an expensive Merlot out of the even more expensive rug, before Donna shrieked that she was only making it worse. Even after the girl was dismissed, the party continued to discuss her.
I just can't believe it, Donna told Stella. What's the point of hiring waiters if they can't hold on to a damn bottle of wine?
The topic bored Stella, to tell the truth. the type of minor skirmish that people fixated on during a party where there was nothing more interesting to discuss. Unlike the math department mixers, where conversations leapt from one topic to another, inscrutable, pretentious, but never boring. She always felt lucky to be in the presence of such brilliant people, thinkers. Blake's colleagues viewed intelligence as a means to an end, and the end was always making more money. But in the mathematics department at Santa Monica College, no one expected to be rich. It was enough to know. She was lucky to spend her days like this, knowing. That night, driving home from the party, she'd found herself thinking about Loretta Walker. Stella was wearing the mink coat Blake had surprised her with that Christmas, and maybe the luxurious fur brushing against her calves reminded her. Or maybe because that morning, when she told Blake that she would be late to the party, they'd fought again about the job that she only had because of Loretta. For months after the Walkers left, she'd fallen into a depression that was deep, even by her own standards. She was grieving for reasons that she could never explain, like she'd lost Desiree all over again. Blake suggested she take a class, which he later regretted, because she brought it up each time he complained about her working.
"You said it yourself," she said during their last argument. "I was going crazy in that house."
"Yes, but," he paused, "I thought you'd, I don't know, take a flower arranging class or something."
But she'd always felt ashamed of being a high school dropout. She felt stupid when someone used a term she didn't understand. She hated asking for directions, even when she was lost. She dreaded the day when her daughter would know more than her, when she would stare at Kennedy's homework, unable to help. So she'd told Blake that she wanted to take a GED class.
"I think that's great, Stell," he'd said.
He was pacifying her, of course, but she signed up for classes anyway. Two nights in a row, she sat in the parking lot outside the public library, afraid to venture inside. She would feel stupid, staring blankly at the chalkboard. When was the last time she'd done any math more complicated than balancing her checkbook? But when she finally went inside, the teacher began to explain an algebra problem, and slowly, she felt 16 again, acing Mrs. Belton's tests. This was what she loved about math. It was the same now as it had been then, and there was always a correct answer, whether she knew it or not. She found that comforting. Blake seemed happy for her when she finally received her diploma in the mail. But he was less thrilled when she announced that she wanted to take classes at Santa Monica College to earn her associate's degree, or when she transferred to Loyola Marymount for her bachelor's, or when last year, Santa Monica College hired her as an adjunct for an introduction to statistics class. The job paid next to nothing, but she felt invigorated during her sections, standing at the chalkboard in front of a dozen undergraduates. Her faculty mentor, Peg Davis, was encouraging her to enroll in a master's program next, even to start thinking about her PhD. She could become a full professor, earn tenure someday. Dr. Stella Sanders had a nice ring, didn't it?
"It's that women's liber,"
he complained, whenever Stella worked late on campus. "She's the one putting all those ideas into your head."
"Surprisingly, I have thoughts of my own," she said.
"Oh, that's not what I meant."
"It's exactly what you meant."
"She's not like you," he said. "You have family, obligations. She just has her politics."
But when had Stella based her decisions on an obligation to family? That was heart space. And maybe it had always been her head guiding her. She had become white because it was practical. So practical that at the time, her decision seemed laughably obvious. Why wouldn't you be white if you could be? Remaining what you were or becoming something new, it was all a choice any way you looked at it. She had just made the rational decision.
I've told you already, you don't have to do this, Blake always said, gesturing to the stacks of tests under her arm. I've always provided for this family.
But she hadn't accepted the job because she was worried about money. She'd just chosen her brain over her heart. And maybe that was what Loretta had seen, tracing that long line down her palm.
You missed my toast,
Blake said when they'd returned from the Hardisons. He was tugging off his tie in the doorway to their closet.
I told you I had to enter grades, she said.
And I told you tonight was important.
What do you want me to say? I tried my best.
He sighed, staring out the darkened window.
Well, it was a nice toast, he said. A nice party.
Yes, she said. The party was lovely.
I know why you're here, Kennedy said. In the half-crowded restaurant, one week after the Midnight Marauders opened, she smiled at Stella across the table, playing with the white tablecloth. She always showed all of her teeth when she smiled, which unnerved Stella. Imagine revealing so much of yourself. One table over, an Asian woman was grading term papers in between spoonfuls of split-pea soup. Two young white men were arguing quietly about John Stuart Mill. Stella said that she had chosen a restaurant near USC's campus because it was convenient, although that wasn't, of course, true. She'd hoped the university crowd might prompt her daughter to rethink her own choices, or at the very least, to feel embarrassed about them. Stella unfurled her napkin, spreading it across her lap.
Of course you do, Stella said. I'm here to have lunch with you.
Kennedy laughed.
Sure, Mother. I'm certain that's the only reason you drove all across the city.
I don't know why you have to turn everything into some big conspiracy. I can't go to lunch with my daughter.
She hadn't driven near campus in years, and even then she'd visited just a handful of times, the college tour, where she'd trailed behind her daughter, gazing skeptically at the trellises climbing the red brick, wondering how a girl with her grades would ever get in. Move-in day, since lackluster test scores were nothing that family donations could not fix. A few shameful weeks later, to plead with the freshman dean after the resident assistant caught Kennedy smoking pot in her room. The drugs bothered Stella less than the indiscretion. Only a lazy girl would get caught, and her daughter was clever, but lazy, blissfully unaware of how hard her mother worked to maintain the lie that was her life. Now Kennedy smirked, slowly stirring her soup.
Fine, she said. We'll just save your lecture for dessert.
There would be no lecture, Stella had promised Blake. She would only nudge Kennedy to do what was right. The girl knew that she needed to go back to school. She'd only missed a semester so far. She could go to the registrar's office, explain that she'd had a mental lapse, and beg her way back in. She would be one term behind her peers. Maybe she could graduate after summer school. Stella worked out various scenarios in her head, each time unable to land anywhere besides her own anger. Quitting school to become an actor. The idea was so idiotic, she could barely restrain herself from saying so as soon as she reached for the menu. The most shocking part? She'd thought Kennedy had already been through her hell years. High school teachers calling because she cut class again. The awful report cards, the nights Stella heard the door creaking open at some ungodly hour and reached for her baseball bat before realizing that it was only her drunk daughter sneaking home. The mangy boys always hanging out of cars in front of the house, honking their horns.
She's my wild child, Blake said once, chuckling, as if it were something to be proud of.
But her wildness only scared Stella, disrupting the careful life she'd built. In the mornings, she'd stared across the breakfast table at a child she no longer recognized. Gone was her sweet-faced girl, and in her place, a tawny, long-limbed woman who changed her mind daily about the person she wanted to be. One morning, a faded Ramones t-shirt hung off her gaunt shoulders. The next, a plaid miniskirt inched up her thighs. And the next, a long dress flowed to her ankles. She'd dyed her hair pink twice.
"Why can't you just be yourself?" Stella asked once.
"Maybe I don't know who that is,"
her daughter shot back. And Stella understood. She did. That was the thrill of youth, the idea that you could be anyone. That was what had captured her in the charm shop all those years ago. Then adulthood came, your choices solidifying, and you realized that everything you are had been set in motion years before. The rest was aftermath. So she understood why her daughter was searching for a self, and she even blamed herself for it. Maybe something in the girl was unsettled, a small part of her realizing that her life wasn't right, as if she'd gotten older and started touching the trees, only to find that they were all cardboard sets.
"There's no lecture," Stella said. "I just want to make sure we're thinking about next semester."
"There it is."
"You didn't miss much time, sweetie. I know you're excited about that play."
"It's a musical,
whatever you call it."
"Well, you'd know if you actually came to opening night."
"How about this?" Stella said. "I'll come to your play if you go down to the registrar."
"Emotional blackmail," she said. "That's a new one for you."
"Blackmail?"
Stella leaned into the table, then dropped her voice.
"Wanting what's best for you is blackmail? Wanting you to get an education, to better yourself?"
"Your best isn't necessarily mine," her daughter said.
But what was Kennedy's best, then? Stella had been shocked and a little embarrassed to learn that her daughter had spent the last semester on academic probation.
"She's young, she'll figure it out," Blake said. But Stella balked.
She was some poor colored girl from nowhere, Louisiana, and even she'd managed a better showing than 2 C-minuses, 2 D's, and a lone B-minus coming from a drama class. Drama wasn't even a class. It was a hobby. A hobby that, months after that dismal semester, her daughter decided she was leaving school to pursue full-time. What was the point, then, of giving a child everything? Buying books for her, enrolling her in the finest schools, hiring tutors, pleading her way into college? What was the point of any of it if the result was only this? One bored girl gazing around a restaurant filled with some of the nation's finest minds and playing idly with her soup.
"College isn't for everyone, you know," Kennedy said.
"Well, it is for you."
"And how do you know that?"
"Because you're a smart girl. I know you are. You just don't try."
"We don't even know what you're capable of when you try your hardest."
"Maybe this is it. I'm not some big brain like you."
"Well, I don't believe that's your best."
"And how would you know?"
"Because I gave up too much for you to flunk out of school."
Kennedy laughed, throwing up her hands.
"Here we go again. It's not my fault you grew up poor, mother. You can't blame me for shit that happened before I was born."
A young black waiter leaned in to refill her water glass, and Stella fell silent. She had chosen her own life years ago. Kennedy had only cemented her into it. Recognizing this wasn't the same as blaming her. She'd sacrificed for a daughter who could never learn what she'd lost. The time for honesty between the two of them had passed long ago. Stella dabbed her mouth with the white napkin, folding it back onto her lap.
"Lower your voice," she said, "and don't swear."
"It's not the end of the world," Peg Davis said. "Lots of students take time off."
Stella sighed, She was sitting across the desk in Peg's cluttered office, which was always so messy that Stella had to slide books off the chair or spend 10 minutes searching for Peg's reading glasses, which were tucked under a pile of midterms. Peg could hire someone to help her organize. Stella had even volunteered to help. The office reminded her of living with Desiree, who'd spent far more time searching for lost things than she would have spent keeping her side of the room neat. But whenever Stella told her this, Desiree had rolled her eyes and said to stop mothering her. Peg was just as dismissive. "Oh, they're around here somewhere," she said each time she misplaced her keys. And like that, another meeting turned into a scavenger hunt. You could be a bit of a wreck when you were a genius. Peg taught number theory, a field of mathematics that seemed so complicated it might as well have been magic. Theoretical mathematics shared little in common with mathematical statistics, but Peg had offered to advise Stella anyway. She was the only tenured female professor in the math department, so she took on all the female students. Their first advising meeting, Peg had leaned back in her chair, studying her. The professor had long, graying blonde hair and wore round eyeglasses that covered half her face.
"So, tell me," she'd said. "What's your story?"
Stella had never been caught so squarely in the gaze of such a brilliant woman before. She fidgeted, twisting her wedding ring around her finger.
"I don't know," she said. "What do you mean? I don't have a story. I mean, nothing that interesting."
She was lying, of course, but she was startled when Peg laughed.
"Like hell," she said. "It's not every day a housewife suddenly decides she wants to take up math. You don't mind if I call you that, do you?"
"Call me what?"
"A housewife."
"No," Stella said. "It's what I am, isn't it?"
"Is it?"
Conversations with Peg always went like this, twisting and turning, questions sounding like answers, answers seeming like questions. Stella always felt like Peg was testing her, which only made her want to prove herself. The professor gave her books, Simone de Beauvoir, Gloria Steinem, Evelyn Reed, and she read them all, even though Blake rolled his eyes when he glanced at the covers. He didn't see what any of that had to do with mathematics. Peg invited her to protests, and even though Stella was always too nervous to stand in a crowd of shouting people, she always read about them afterward in the paper.
"What are Peggy's girls up to this time?" Blake would ask, peeking over her shoulder at the local section. There they were, protesting the Miss America pageant, a sexist advertisement inside Los Angeles Magazine, the opening of a new slasher movie that glorified violence against women. Peggy's girls were all white, and when Stella asked once if there were any Negro women in the group, Peg prickled.
"They have their own concerns, you know," she said.
"But they're welcome to join us in the fight."
Who was Stella to judge? At least Peg stood for something, fought for something. She went to war with the university over everything. Paid maternity leave, sexist faculty hiring, and exploitation of adjunct labor. She argued about these things even though she had no children and had already secured tenure. She argued even though her advocating wouldn't benefit her at all. It baffled Stella. Protesting out of a sense of duty, or maybe even amusement. Now, sitting in Peg's office, she reached for a volume on prime numbers and said,
"It's only time off if you eventually go back."
"Well, maybe she will," Peg said. "On her own." "You did."
"That's different."
"How?"
"I didn't have a choice," she said. "I had to leave school. When I was her age, the only thing I wanted was to go to college, and she just throws it away."
"Well, she isn't you," Peg said. "It's unfair for you to expect her to be."
It wasn't that either, or at least, it wasn't only that. Her daughter felt like a stranger, and maybe if she was still in Mallard, she would be amused by all the ways that they were different, by all the ways her daughter reminded her of Desiree, even. She might laugh with her sister about it. Are you sure she's not yours? But here in this world, her daughter felt like a stranger, and it terrified her. If her daughter didn't feel like she was really hers, then nothing about her life was real.
Maybe you're actually upset at yourself,
Peg said.
Myself? Why?
All those years you've been talking about graduate school and nothing?
Yes, but...
Stella stopped. That was a different matter altogether. Each time she talked to Blake about applying to a master's program, he reacted as childishly as she expected. More school? Christ, Stella, how much more school do you need? He accused her of abandoning the family. She accused him of abandoning her. Both fell asleep angry.
I mean, of course, that husband thinks he can still push you around, Peg said. You frighten him. A woman with a brain. Nothing scares them more.
I don't know if that's true, Stella said. Blake was still her husband. She didn't like hearing anyone talk about his faults.
I just mean it's all about power, Peg said. He wants it, and he doesn't want you to have it. Why else do you think men fuck their secretaries?
Again, she regretted telling Peg how she and Blake met. Their story, romantic at the time, only became crasser over the years. She was so young. Her daughter's age. She'd never met a man like Blake before. Of course, she hadn't been able to resist his pull. Their first time in bed, she was only 19, along with Blake on a work trip to Philadelphia. By then, she'd learned that being a secretary was a little like being a wife. She memorized his schedule, hung his hat and coat, poured him a scotch. She brought him lunch, managed his moods, listened to him complain about his father. Remembered to send his mother flowers for her birthday. This was why he'd invited her to Philadelphia, she thought. Until the final night of the trip, when he leaned in at the hotel bar and kissed her.
You don't know how long I've been wanting to do that, he said. Since Antoine's. You looked so sweet and so lost. I knew I was in trouble then. I told them, find me a girl with the nicest handwriting. It doesn't matter if she isn't much to look at. I hoped you wouldn't be. I didn't need the distraction. I'm not that sort of man, you see. But of course, the prettiest handwriting belonged to the prettiest girl. And you've been torturing me ever since.
He laughed a little, but he was gazing at her so seriously she felt her neck flush.
I didn't mean to, she said. Torture you, I mean.
Do you hate me for telling you all of this? He said.
His nervousness settled her. She'd gone on a few dates with white men before, but never made it past kissing in their cars. She was always afraid that they might be able to read her lie somehow on her naked body. Maybe against white sheets, her skin would look darker. Or maybe she would just feel different once he was inside of her. If nakedness would not reveal who you were, then what would? In the hotel room, Blake slowly undressed her. He unzipped her skirt, unclipped her bra, bent to unfurl her nylons. He was straining against his white briefs, and she felt embarrassed for him. Embarrassed for all men, really, forced to wear their desires so openly. She could think of nothing more horrifying than not being able to hide what she wanted. She couldn't have said no to him, she'd since realized, but she didn't want to. And maybe that was the difference. Or maybe the difference was in thinking that there was one at all.
Don't look at me like that, Peg said.
Like what?
Like your cat just died.
Peg leaned across the desk.
I just hate to see you make yourself small for him. Just because he'll never see you the way you see yourself.
Stella glanced away.
You don't understand, she said. When I think about who I was before him, it's like being a whole other person.
So who were you then?
Peg said. Sometimes being a twin had felt like living with another version of yourself. That person existed for everyone, probably, an alternative self that lived only in the mind. But hers was real. Stella rolled over in bed each morning and looked into her eyes. Other times it felt like living with a foreigner. Why are you not more like me? She'd think, glancing over at Desiree. How did I become me and you become you? Maybe she was only quiet because Desiree was not. Maybe they'd spent their lives together modulating each other, making up for what the other lacked, like how at their father's funeral, Stella barely spoke, and when someone asked her a question, Desiree answered instead. At first, it unnerved Stella, a person speaking to her and Desiree responding, like throwing her own voice. But soon she felt comfortable disappearing. You could say nothing, and in your nothingness, feel free. She stared out the window at students biking past, then back to the professor. I can't even remember, she said. Chapter 12. By the end of Jude's first 2 weeks as the newest usher at the Stardust Theater, she'd already learned two main things about Kennedy Sanders. She wanted to be a Broadway star, and she carried herself like every aggrieved actress, a little prideful, a little wounded. The pride was impossible to miss. She delighted in making others wait for her, sauntering through every held door. She argued with the director over the delivery of lines, often, it seemed, for fun. She parked her red sports car on the far side of the garage because she claimed it had once been keyed by a jealous understudy. She liked to invent stories about her life, as if the reality were too dull to repeat. Sometimes she revised herself in the middle of a conversation, like when she told Jude that her car had been a high school graduation gift.
No, more like a we can't believe you graduated gift, she said. I was a little shit in high school. But weren't we all? I mean, maybe not. You don't look like a little shit to me.
I wasn't, Jude said.
I know you weren't. See, I can always tell. Who ate their broccoli and listened to Daddy, and who was a fucking hellraiser. Hey, be a doll and throw this away, will you?
In her dressing room, she dropped crumpled candy wrappers into Jude's waiting hands. For the past 2 weekends, Jude had ridden the bus downtown to the decrepit theater, where she swept popcorn off the floors, scrubbed the bathroom sinks, and cleaned out the dressing rooms. In time, her supervisor promised, she would work her way up to ticket-taking and seat-directing. Little did he know, she was exactly where she wanted to be. But of course, she didn't tell him that. She'd only given him the simple story, that she was a recent college graduate looking to earn extra money on the weekends. She could work Friday and Saturday nights, Sunday afternoons. The Midnight Marauders shifts. He told her to come back for the Sunday matinee, dressed in all black.
I don't like it, Reese said.
He leaned against the kitchen countertop, Mr. Song's worn tool belt still around his waist, looking so worried, she wished she hadn't said anything in the first place.
It's just a little side job, she said lightly. We could use the money.
It's not, and you know it.
Well, what am I supposed to do? Just go on pretending she ain't Stella's daughter? I can't do that. I have to know her. I have to meet Stella.
And how you plan on doing that?
But she had no plan beyond the Stardust Theater. Before each show, she met Kennedy in her dressing room and helped lift the big dress over her head. She did other little favors for her, too. Brought her hot water with lemon, fetched her sandwiches from a nearby diner, ran for Cokes from the lobby vending machine. She always felt foolish, standing outside the dressing room, holding a steaming mug of tea, until Kennedy whisked in, breathless and unapologetic.
You're a lifesaver, she'd say, or I owe you one.
never just thank you. During the first act, before preparing the concession stand for intermission, Jude slipped into the wing to watch a play that became sillier the more times she saw it. A Western musical about a spunky girl who arrives in a ghost town to find it occupied by actual ghosts.
I think it's very clever, Kennedy said. Sort of like Hamlet when you think about it.
The play was nothing like Hamlet, but she said it with such conviction that you almost believed her. It was the first starring role she'd landed since dropping out of school 2 months ago, she told Jude one evening after a show. They were sitting together at a diner across the street, Kennedy dipping fries into a puddle of ranch.
My mother still hasn't been to a show, she said. She's so pissed at me for leaving school. She thinks I'm gambling away my future. And maybe I am. Hardly anyone makes it, right?
For the first time, she dropped the bravado, looking so genuinely unsure of herself that Jude almost squeezed her hand. The sudden rush of empathy startled her. Was that what it was like to be this girl? An unwise choice earning you sympathy, not scorn. A single moment of doubt forcing a practical stranger to affirm that you were, in fact, special?
No one gets into med school either, Jude said.
Oh, it's not the same. My mother would love if I were going to be a doctor, trust me. I suppose most mothers would. They all want us to live better lives than they did, right?
What was hers like?
Rough, you know, real white trash grapes of wrath, walked 10 miles each day just to get to school, all that.
She come from a big family?
Oh, no, just her. But her mother and father died years ago. She's the only one left.
Sometimes you could understand why Stella passed over. Who didn't dream of leaving herself behind and starting over as someone new? But how could she kill the people who'd loved her? How could she leave the people who still longed for her years later and never even look back? That was the part that Jude could never understand.
I don't know how you put up with her, Barry said. That girl never stops talking. I'd shove that bonnet in her mouth.
Like the rest of the cast, he found Kennedy insufferable. But Jude needed to hear her talk. She was searching all of her stories for Stella. So she lifted that dress over her head, listening to Kennedy go on about how she wanted to visit India over the summer. But she was worried, you know. You can't even drink the water in a place like that. And she had a friend, well, not really a friend, a childhood neighbor, Tammy Roberts, who went on a mission trip there and came back sick from eating fruit. Can you imagine it? Fruit? She'd rather die with a needle jabbed in her arm than let a mango kill her. Another time, Kennedy told her that an old fling would be in the audience, a married surfer who lived in her apartment building. She'd slept with him once after he brought a bottle of absinthe back from France.
We saw some trippy shit, she said, stretching out barefoot on the lumpy couch.
Curtin was in 15, and she still wasn't even dressed yet. She was never focused, never prepared. When Jude arrived to help her dress, she always answered the door a little surprised, as if she hadn't been the one to ask Jude in the first place. She always mentioned her mother suddenly, like when she told Jude before a show that she had first started acting when she was 11. Her mother had placed her in all of these different activities, because that's what parents do in Brentwood, cast their children out like a fishing net and hope that they catch a talent. So she'd taken tennis lessons and ballet classes and clarinet and piano, enough instruments to start her own symphony, really. But nothing stuck. She was horribly mediocre. Her mother was embarrassed.
She never said as much, but I could tell, Kennedy said. She really wanted me to be special.
So on a whim, she'd auditioned for a school play about the gold rush and earned a small role as a Chinese railroad worker. Only 7 lines, but her mother helped her memorize them, holding the script in one hand, stirring pasta sauce with the other. Kennedy dragging her invisible pick across the kitchen floor.
I mean, it was completely ridiculous, she said. Here I am, playing some coolie in one of those straw hats. You couldn't even see my face. But my mother told me I did a good job. She was, I don't know, she seemed excited for once. She spoke about her mother wistfully, the way everyone talked about Stella. That was the only part that felt real. For the rest of November, Jude Winston worked the Midnight Marauders shift. She refilled the popcorn machines, passed out playbills at the door, helped old ladies to their seats. At night, she fell asleep, still hearing the overture. She closed her eyes and saw Kennedy at center stage, glowing in light. They couldn't be cousins. Each time the blonde swept into the theater, her face hidden behind sunglasses, the idea seemed even more preposterous. A long-lost relative. You'd have something in common, wouldn't you? Maybe you couldn't spot it at first, but in time you'd feel, somehow, your shared blood. But the longer she spent around Kennedy, the more foreign the girl seemed. One Friday night, the cast went out for a nightcap. Barry tugged Jude's arm to convince her to stay, but before she could tell him that she was exhausted, Kennedy jogged out beside her. So of course she'd stayed. She never told her no. She felt desperate around her. The play was nearly over, and she'd barely learned anything about Stella. In the dim bar, the pianist found a dusty upright in the back and started picking around chords. Slowly, the cast migrated over, a little tipsy and still eager to perform. But Kennedy sat with Jude at the worn end of the table, their knees touching. "You don't have many friends like me, do you?" she asked.
"What do you mean?"
"White people, probably," although Kennedy surprised her by saying, "Girlfriends. You were with a whole bunch of boys when I saw you."
"No," Jude said. "I don't have any girlfriends, really."
"Why not?"
"I don't know. I never really had any growing up. It's the place I come from. They don't like people like me."
"Blacks, you mean?"
"Dark ones," she said. "The light ones are fine."
Kennedy laughed. "Well, that's silly."
They both found each other's lives inscrutable. And wasn't that the only way it could be? Didn't Jude wonder what it would be like to care so little about your education? To know that even if the worst happened, you would be all right? Didn't she hate the loud punk rock screeching out the speakers when Kennedy peeled into the parking garage? Yes, and she rolled her eyes each time Kennedy arrived late. She resented when Kennedy demanded lemon tea. She felt defensive when Barry called her a spoiled brat, even though she was one. Of course she was. The girl was maddening sometimes. But maybe this was who Jude would have been if her mother hadn't married a dark man. In this other life, the twins passed over together. Her mother married a white man, and now she slipped out of mink coats at fancy parties, not wait at tables in a country diner. In this reality, Jude was fair and beautiful, driving a red Camaro around Brentwood, her hand trailing out the window. Each night she strutted on stage, beaming, tossing back her golden hair while the world applauded. The boy on the piano started banging out, "Don't Stop Me Now," and Kennedy shrieked, grabbing Jude by the hand. Jude never sang in front of anybody, but somehow she found herself singing along with the giddy group, annoying the other patrons, until the bartender kicked them out. She climbed into bed that night after 3, her head buzzing, still feeling Kennedy's arm around her shoulders. They weren't real family, and they weren't real friends, but they were something, weren't they?
"Where'd you go?"
Reese asked. They were kissing in bed, but she was distracted, her head still swimming with music.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I'm just thinking."
"About that white girl,"
he sighed.
"Baby, you gotta stop. You're playing a dangerous game."
"It's not a game," she said.